8:32, and I would like to welcome everyone to the Arizona Board of Psychologists Examiners Legislative and Rule Committee. And good morning. Could we please have a roll call?
Yes, Madam Chair. Ms. Shreve?
Present.
Mr. Dinar?
Present.
Dr. Davey? Absent. And Dr. Meyer?
Present.
Perfect. Thank you. You have a quorum.
Great. Thank you very much. I'd like to thank the staff for getting us all prepped and getting us all our material. We'll now move to agenda item number 3, discussion, consideration, and possible action concerning potential proposed legislative changes before the 2023-56 Arizona State Legislative First Regular Session. Boy, there's a big, long agenda item. So I'll turn it over to Heidi.
I don't challenge you intentionally. So hopefully this format was helpful. It was useful, but if you found that it wasn't so much, please send me your feedback. This Google Sheet represents the instances where either these issues were raised during a board meeting, maybe a committee meeting, and also some instances where board staff just wanted to present a concept to this committee for consideration. So I've organized it by statutes and rules. It makes sense, I think, you know, to start with the statutes and just work our way through this list. And so what I am hoping for the outcome with each item that we discuss is that there's a determination whether to forward it to the board with a recommendation or not forward it, or, you know, potentially hold that item for more research and maybe stakeholder input. So that's what I'm hoping to obtain from all of you today. So if you're ready to dive in, we can start with, and I put these in sequential order just because that made sense in my mind. So 32-2061, subsection 16cc. So the lengthy list of instances of unprofessional conduct. The issue of the meaning of this subsection has been discussed by the board fairly recently. Dr. Akins brought this question to the board of, you know, what this means relative to what seemed to be a conflict with the language in the APA Code of Ethics. And so, Mr. Dinar, you remember, of course, that you had done your research and found that there were two instances in the semi-recent past where the board thought modification of this language. And so I went back to the, it was an omnibus bill in 2008 that really made this change and flipped the language from excluding to including. So there was no rationale that I could find for why that statutory change was sought. It was in a big omnibus bill, and that was well documented except for the reasons. So this compelled me to meet with Dr. Cindy Olvey, former executive director of this board. And when she joined the board, this legislation was already well on its way to passing. But what she remembered was that the board at the time was trying to align this grounds for unprofessional conduct to the code of ethics. But in doing so, they did it imperfectly. So in talking with Dr. Olvey, what we think that would work is that if we strike the language and change including back to excluding, and then also striking the language psychometric testing materials and other information as provided by the board, that brings the statute language in alignment with the APA Code of Ethics. I hope that makes sense, but let me know if you have any questions.
Madam Chair, if I may, so thank you, Ms. Pekkanen, for that background. I mean, this is something we have to resolve one way or the other. I also remember, just to sort of, you know, while it's fresh in my mind, that one of the other board members had talked about the copyright implications of saying including versus excluding. So I just want everyone to sort of, you know, think about that issue as well. So I mean, I'm just making a preliminary comment just to make sure that we are also thinking of that issue, and then we can discuss it. Thank you. Right.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Meyer?
Yeah, I thought coming out of that conversation in the board meeting that the decision was that it was already, it made sense that the way it was, that law, copyright law allowed you to not share this. Isn't, mm-hmm. cause that's what Dr. Dinard or Mr. Dinard had elucidated, right?
Dr. Meyer, I do remember mostly Ms. Galvin indicating that she did not, exactly what you said, that she didn't see this language as being particularly problematic. There was some acknowledgement, however, that it could still be confusing to anyone, you know, reading this language, the statute language, and comparing it to the Code of Ethics. So, it can be legally explained, but confusion could still ensue. So really the question is, do you agree with that? And do you feel that this rises to the level of, you know, requiring a change to clear up potential confusion?
So well, Madam Chair, if I...
Well, we had said maybe just a policy or, statement, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. Mr. Dinard?
So my thought is there's sort of like two different ways of looking at this. One is what's really the purpose of saying that it's unprofessional conduct to not hand over this information? So when a patient or a client or the client or patient's designated representative is making a request, they are, again, I don't know, and Ms. Packinen couldn't find the reasons why the legislature put the including language. But my sense is the reason it would be including is because the context in which this sort of information is requested by the client and the patient is to potentially use it in litigation. In litigation, we you know, it's a routine matter to sort of test or probe the expertise of the expert witness. And we, you know, we use fancy words, we daubertize the witness or we fry the witness, not fry in oil, it's F-R-Y-E, it's a case that says,
thanks,
you know.
Thanks for clarifying that, I was wondering.
Yeah, just trying to inject humor in an otherwise, you know, boring proceeding. But I mean, I'm thinking that the context in which the information, like psychometric testing materials and raw data, is being requested is for the Daubert sort of, you know, Daubertizing or frying sort of, you know, purposes. So it makes sense in my mind to keep the language as including. And I think Dr. Davis Wilson had brought up the point that in the behavior analyst statute, it's excluding. So my thought was to make both statutes, the psychology statute and the behavior analyst statute, say including raw data, psychometric testing materials, and other information that's provided by law. So that's one way of thinking about this. The other way of thinking about this is, so when the legislature changed the psychology side of the unprofessional conduct to including, there was some discussion many years ago about how to deal with copyright law and like states that require materials that are viewed as copyrighted in certain contexts. And the way that all of that litigation and that sort of policy discussion between the copyright holders and the legislators shook, you know, the cards when they fell when that discussion was going on, it came down to saying, well, you have to still disclose copyrightable material, but you could negotiate some kind of a confidentiality or protective order, sort of a an arrangement where that copyrighted information is not widely available to the public at large. So that also tells me that the reason for having an including language was because the legislature was probably thinking about a litigation context in which this information will be disclosed. And in that context, it's just routine to have some kind of a order of protection or confidentiality, kind of an order. It's just routine. I mean, no one thinks twice before entering into something like that. So those are sort of the two ways that I was thinking about this. And I was leaning in favor of saying including in both the psychology statute and the behavior analyst statute. Is that a perfect solution? Is it going to make a few people grumpy? Probably, but I mean, I don't see sort of like counter arguments, or I don't see arguments that are as strong as that to switch it from including to excluding everywhere. I may be wrong, but I mean, that's my sense of history and like how to solve this. Thank you.
Dr. Meyer, sorry, he has on mute.
So I'd just add in the psychology perspective on this. When HIPAA came about, it required us to release much more of our medical records than what anybody wanted to. And so there's been this kind of push and pull on what needs to be released versus like so many psychologists would fall back on, well, it could harm the patient if they read all of this stuff. And so psychologists typically did not release that much. And HIPAA required much more access to all records for clients. The issue with the testing is not only the copyright, though, and so while psychologists have pretty much gotten on board with like therapy notes and all the other records, those get released. Everybody gets that now. But with testing, it's still different because not only is there the copyright, there's also the test security issue that, if the actual materials, are publicly available or get out, then it's very difficult to, be able to accurately interpret the results of those testing materials, because you can find how you're supposed to answer it based on the what you're trying to portray. And so there's been so much focus on and that's typically fought through copyright to keep it out of the keep that access limited. But that's the concern is it's really hard to it's already hard to test for malingering and to test for to document validity of these tests if people have discussed, well, here's what you have to say here. So that's the argument. If the inclusion was a mistake, then I think it really makes sense to go back to excluding, because psychologists give the material or the results of the tests. It's just the test booklets, the actual the stimuli that really needs to be protected for assessment to be as valid as possible. So I guess going back to the exclude, now that we've learned that was probably a mistake, it makes a lot more sense to me to go back to excluding.
Madam Chair, Dr. Meyer, are you Are you indicating changing it back to excluding plus striking the language, psychometric testing materials, and other information as provided by law? Doing those things in tandem?
Well, now I'm confused.
So that's what Dr. Olvey and I wondered, if it was really, we need to be more precise, more surgical about what is to be included and what is to be excluded.
So, Madam Chair, Ms. Pakkanen, I think what you're saying is subsection CC will say failing to make available to the client or patient or the client's or patient's designated representative, blah, 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 written copy of client's patient record excluding
raw test data as provided by law.
As provided by law.
Yes.
So, and psychometric test stream materials, right?
So that would be excluded as well. So that would be, I think what that does, though, is that takes this language out of alignment with the APA code. Because the APA code, yes, that would be, we would be out of alignment with the code for what that is worth.
So what are the pros and cons of including versus excluding raw test data? I mean, I obviously don't have as good of a grasp on that as Dr. Meyer or, you know, practitioners in the field. So I'm looking for sort of more information to inform my opinion on this.
And let me ask a quick question, Dr. Diner. I mean, Mr. Diner, if we exclude it, and let's say you do need it for litigation, then you could subpoena it. Then that's that you can't get around a subpoena, right? I mean, there's a way to get it if that's what you wanted.
Well, so I think right now there is a presumption that you get it, whereas what you're suggesting, Ms. Shreve, that makes it like so much more harder.
Yeah.
In a litigation context. So I guess, I mean, we are thinking of, what's the presumption we want to create? So it's the presumption that you include this if in the litigation, or maybe the solution is, you know, we explain the contexts in which this material has to be included. And by implication, then the context in which the material can be excluded is whatever that's not mentioned. So maybe like the surgical approach might be, you know, what context are you going to include this material? What context you're going to exclude this material? I'm just thinking aloud. I don't have a solution.
So a question then, Dr. Meyer, when you take these tests, are the answers on a like a bubble sheet, or are they actually in the test document, like where the test? I mean, is it when I say, hey, let me see my results, am I getting my bubble sheet, or am I getting, you know, like, or am I getting a document where I says, you know, blah, 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 and I circled the right one? I mean, what is it if I were to say I want all my documents?
Right. And so it's different for each test. When you're doing a personality test like the MMPI, it's, you have 456 question, true false questions. And so all those questions are listed and you just fill in the bubbles for true or false. But then there's also the scoring sheet where you take the different questions to go on each scale and then plot that. So it versus the WACE, which is an intelligence exam, that scoring sheet is on the front page, but all the questions are on the same booklet behind that, and you're filling in the answers on that single booklet. So sometimes it's separated, sometimes it's not.
So if I'm a patient and I want all my material, I guess, you know, I paid for it in essence, right? Is it not mine? And is it available on the internet if we're actually to go out and search? I don't know. That's the thing
is keeping these booklets and the specific questions, the booklets, all of that scoring, keeping that off the internet is really important for these tests to remain valid. The I was going to go back to something Mr. Dinar said, and I forgot it now. So you said you paid for this. Isn't this yours? Well, no, you paid for my expertise to administer a validated test and interpret that. That's the issue with the way that psychological assessment has been carved out, is that for most of these assessments, only psychologists are trained to interpret it. The actual administration is oftentimes done by a master's or even bachelor's level person, because it's just answer the question and record what they say. It's the interpretation that is what psychologists are trained to do, and say, this is what that means. And that's what a client is paying for, is to say, yeah, we've taken all kinds of data, and here's what this means. Okay. But when you can go out and see the questions and you see discussions on how to answer it, that's already there. You can find some, here's the way to try to game the system. Now you don't see the actual questions there, so it's just kind of more general, but, mm-hmm. but there's some of that, out there of how to get around this test. When that's the case, then the validity of these, assessments is out the window. You no longer can take at face value that what was answered is actually based on this person.
Right.
And that becomes really important. That becomes really important for especially evaluations in criminal settings, where you're looking at, is a person competent to stand trial, or is a person faking bad or faking good, as well as career assessment, where you're trying to get a job, and so you're trying to put your best face forward. It becomes, that's already tough to do. It becomes impossible if people have access to these records.
Madam Chair, thank you, Dr. Meyer. That was very helpful discussion that sort of helped me think about the issue. So I think what I'm hearing is, again, going back to Ms. Pekkanen's recommendation, was to say including raw test data as provided by law. So I think that satisfies everybody, because you're taking out psychometric testing material. So you do not have to include psychometric testing materials. I think Dr. Meyer makes a very good point about, you know, the integrity of the testing and the interpretation of the tests by the psychologist. So does that resolve Dr. Meyer's concerns?
So the issue is, how do you release the raw test data for some of these assessments without also disclosing the, because so for the intelligence assessment, you write the client's answers on the test booklet. And so to give them the raw test data is giving them the stimulus material as well. That's the problem, is the way these are, they're scored. For many assessments, I cannot give you the raw test data without also giving you the stimuli. It's an issue, I think, that if we move to this standardized approach where raw test data was a separate form for everything, then we could give that without giving the stimuli, but that's not the case. And I mean, that would take a monstrous amount of work in the field to move to that. And I haven't seen any indication that's trying to be done. So I did remember what you had asked Mr. Dinar about the purpose of this, releasing this material. Whenever I'm looking at a psychological report from somebody else, I'm looking to see what are the scores they reported for the test and how they interpreted it. I'm assuming, based on being licensed, that they're competent, that they scored it correctly. The only time I would be wanting to look at raw data is to compare it to the final scores that they reported to see if a mistake was made. Or back to your part, frying the psychologists under the examination to say, to challenge their competency. And that happens, right? So, everybody makes mistakes and you can transpose a number or, you can make a mistake getting from the raw test data to the scores and you're using those scores to interpret the results. So, there is a case if you think there's a mistake or you think there's, concerns about competency, you would want that raw data. But in general, those are going to be very specific cases. And it's really, that's not something that a layperson, would likely be able to do because you have to have access to the scoring materials beyond just the, raw data and the stimuli. So, I think that it could be done under certain circumstances, but to throw the raw data and the stimuli to anybody because they have access to their medical records, it really could impact the validity of psychological assessment in general. So in going back to saying, do we get rid of just psychometric testing materials? So we say including raw test data and psychometric testing materials. The problem is sometimes those are the same thing. And so to just take off one is still going to leave this question on how do I comply with this?
So, Madam Chair, thank you, Dr. Meyer. That really was very clarifying for me personally speaking. So I'm trying to think of a situation where let's say we have excluding the following language. We have excluding raw test data, psychometric testing materials, and other information as provided by law. So you're basically switching including to excluding. So I'm trying to think of the kind of unprofessional conduct cases that are going to come up, right? So in a situation where a licensee says, I'm not going to disclose any of this material in a litigation context where, you know, that person as a witness is going through a Daubert evaluation or a Frye evaluation, then are you saying that as provided by law, so if a court orders them to hand over that information, they would be saying, well, but my statute says excluding.
No, so because this is talking about to a client or patient or client or patient's designated representative, right? So this does not protect you from, I can't withhold it based on a subpoena, based on a bench subpoena.
Okay. No, that answers my question. Excluding makes sense.
Right. And normally when, sorry, I keep interrupting you. Normally when the competency is going to be challenged, like a psychologist would be expected to submit the raw data and all testing materials to the board for review. And if a psychologist's competency is being challenged, the opposing side's going to have another psychologist that is interpreting this and looking at it. And we are expected to release this information to other psychologists when the client's requesting that. It's because a psychologist is bound to, by law, to keep this confidential, right? It's when we just send it out to anybody who wants it, that's where we get into the issues. So there's still, even if we say excluding the raw test data and the stimuli here, that it's not like that is going to, a psychologist wouldn't be able to hide behind that if their competency was being challenged.
So you want to make a motion?
Well, I guess we're saying go back to just change this to excluding and be done with it, right? Is that the...
I'll second that.
All right, we got a motion to exclude and a second.
We would change the wording in CC back to excluding raw test data. So we're just changing the word excluding. So I'd make a motion to forward that to the full board for approval to make that change.
Second.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none. Moves forward to the board. Next item is Pakenham. Oh, you're on mute. I do that all the time.
This one I think is pretty straightforward. I'm sorry we weren't more precise with the subsection in 32.20.71. We think that the it's grammatically incorrect at 32.20.71A4. And under 4, there are little a, b, c, d, and so forth. There are 3 instances at C, D, and E of the word basis, and it appears to be grammatically incorrect because we think those are plural and they should be bases.
I'm sorry.
Right?
Heidi, it's bases. E-S, it's a spelling error, not a grammar error.
Okay.
For some reason, our statute says B-A-S-I-S, which it shouldn't. It's the correct spelling is B-A-S-E-S in all okay. those.
All right. I thought bases were plural of basis. No.
I don't think so. Dr. Meyer, you would know.
I don't know what the plural of basis is, but that is supposed to be B-A-S-E-S. I've okay. never noticed that.
Okay.
But yeah, that it should be B-A-S-E-S.
So, okay, very good. So we would not ask a legislator to correct only this, but we would call their attention to the fact that we think this is correct and then let the legislative council staff address it.
All right. Can we just all nod that it's going to go to the board? All right.
Let's do consensus. Yeah. Okay, very good. Thank you. And then if you're ready, we can go to the next
item. I'll just let you flow through these.
Very good.
Some of them will be pretty quick.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So we do have the stakeholder present who submitted this comment. I believe you had an opportunity to read the full letter in your folder, but essentially the comment is captured in the spreadsheet. And if we have Dr. Bushnell here or someone from her group, maybe, Madam Chair, do we want to hear from the stakeholder?
Sure. Is the stakeholder here?
Hi. Yes, this is Mary Lou Bushnell. I'm here.
Great. We'd love to hear any comments you have.
Hi. Yes. Thank you for the time. So I'm the director of training for the neuropsychology residency at the Phoenix VA. And it's come to my attention in recent years that our residents are unable to meet the licensure requirements because of the 40% direct client contact requirement, needing to be face-to-face hours. So in neuropsychological assessments, our direct contact hours actually do include the scoring, the chart review, and the report writing. And so certainly they meet that if we included that, but they've been given feedback that their hours, only the clinical interview and the neuropsychological testing would count, which makes them unable to meet that 40%. So I just wanted to bring that to the attention and see if we could have that wording changed where all of the billable hours would count as direct client contact hours.
Thank you. Comments?
So I've never, on the application review committee, I've never rejected a case that I recall of because of this issue.
Does our law specifically say we don't accept those report writing, blah, blah, blah?
No, it just talks about direct client contact. So I my guess is that it's just based on how applicants are interpreting that and filling it out.
So if you're working on a client's report writing, isn't, or do we see that as working on a client, or is it strictly face to face giving counseling, or, you know,
good question. Well, I see the issue here, because typically, as Dr. Bushnell just said, the report writing also includes that interpretation of the data that we were just talking about in the last issue. That's like the applied psychological practice. It's typically seen as different than just doing writing progress notes based on therapy contact.
Let me ask this, Dr. Meyer. I'm just trying to think this through as a public member. What is the purpose? I mean, the purpose of the contact, the 48%, is that they're getting experience, right? They're getting, they're practicing their applied skills. So is this a big issue if they're applying those skills to report writing or other? I'm not even sure what falls under everything that's billable, but, and what do you, right. I mean, you're the practicing psychologist here.
Well, I think that the purpose of having the 40% direct client contact is to make sure that they're practicing under supervision to gain that experience. And for a neuropsychologist, the interpretation, scoring, interpretation, and report writing is part of the professional practice. So I wouldn't see that as being an issue, but I think that there's something to be said for us having that 40% minimum requirement, because that's typically we occasionally come across placements that they're not actually doing psychological work. And so having that requirement, I think, is important. I think expanding our definition to better cover neuropsychologists would not be a bad idea. I just haven't come across this in 4 years now as being an issue on any applications. Dr. Bushnell, have you had students, like, what feedback have you received?
Yeah, so I would agree with you. I've been working there for 15 years, and for many years it wasn't an issue. But in the last couple of years, two of my residents that are completing this two-year APA absent approved fellowship were actually, their applications were rejected. And they were saying, even if they complete the entire two-year fellowship, which is very rigorous, they will never meet that 40% face-to-face because they're not, you know, that direct contact. And so both of them, unfortunately, had to pursue licensure in other states. So, yeah, it hasn't been an issue in the past, but recently I had these two in a row. And, again, I agree with you. I think the 40% is absolutely important. And if anything, my students have more than that. But it's just that language, and I know it's open to interpretation, but two times it's been interpreted that because they include that scoring, report writing, all of that, that did not meet that face-to-face requirement, and that was the reason for the rejection of their applications.
So Dr. Myers, is there enough difference between neuropsych and, I guess, regular psych, as far as that you would distinguish between the two and what we would accept?
No, I don't think you'd, we don't license specialty applications. You're either a licensed psychologist or not, but it's absolutely, appropriate to be doing a, for your, residency to be focused on neuropsych, because to become a board certified neuropsych, you have to have 2 years of, residency. So, we need more neuropsychologists, and I really hope I wasn't a part of this, because it doesn't make sense of rejecting that. I do think we should, maybe offline, if Dr. Bushnell would be willing to supply the names of those people so that we could look at their applications and see if what the issue was. But yeah, I think this is, that's really unfortunate that we didn't approve that based on this requirement.
Mr. Diner, I think, did you have a comment?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So my comment was, or question rather was, when I'm looking at 40% of the supervisor's time shall be in direct contact with clients or patients. So I think the issue is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but from today's discussion on the previous matter, it seems like there is like a master's or bachelor's level person who gives the test, so maybe like the 500 question test. So that person is the one who is having direct contact with the client or patient. And then it's the neuropsychology trainee or supervisee is then interpreting those test results. So that person is not having a direct contact with the client or patient. Is that the issue? I mean, am I thinking about this right?
Well, usually during training, the psychologist or psychologist in training, the resident is also administering a lot of the tests. It's not always done. You can have a psychometrist that's doing the actual administration sometimes, but for training purposes, we usually require the psychologist trainee to be administering those. It's just that the face-to-face contact of administering the assessments is less than the amount of time you spend scoring, interpreting, and writing. And so if I'm 25% of my time may be face-to-face to do a full psychological assessment. And so if I'm just doing assessments, then I'm only going to have 25% of my time as direct face-to-face.
So do we agree that this is an issue we need to maybe look at and take to the board, and then maybe have some, I would be interested in, you know, a practicing neuro, I guess some more opinion, maybe from another neuropsychologist on how do we handle that? Do we think, so if we say that, we're looking at those test results and writing the reports is considered a face-to-face contact, then that would also go for psychologists.
So here's the issue. For internship applications, and a lot of our hours and requirements are based on what it takes to be competitive and go get an internship. It specifically says that you write in the total number of face-to-face client contact hours, administering instruments and providing feedback to clients. You should not include the activities of scoring and report writing, which should instead be included in the support activities section.
Wow.
So that's how we typically tell people to report their hours, because that's a standard. Every psychologist has to go to internship before completing their doctorate.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be very odd to make, to change that for postdoc. And that's where our 40% requirement comes in to be an issue for some people, I guess.
So, Madam Chair, so I think, I mean, the way I'm seeing this, the purpose of the 40% is we are essentially saying in postdoc, spend at least 40% of your time in that sort of face-to-face contact with patient or client and 60% on everything else. And I mean, it seems to me if that's reasonable to for everyone other than neuropsychologists, and given the fact that we don't do a specialty license for neuropsychologists, it makes sense to keep it 40% from what I'm seeing, from what I'm hearing Dr. Meyer say. But again, I'm really open. Maybe there's room for further research on this. Is there any sort of, do we need to look at how the other states have divided up the postdoc experience, 40, 60, 30, 70, 35, 65? I don't know. Maybe that will give us some information or insight into how to deal with this, because it seems like what Dr. Bushnell was saying, her postdoc candidates were able to get licensure elsewhere. So that's telling me that either their requirement is not 40-60, or they look at the 40% differently than we do. I mean, in terms of what we view as direct contact may be different from what these other state boards are thinking about when they look at direct contact. So maybe that information will help us.
Yeah. And Dr. Bushnell, is your program pretty standard as far as if you went to another state and another program like yours, that the amount of time on the report writing? I mean, if we went to, is that kind of your standard neural psych? Is that standard, or would there possibly be other opportunities to make it more 40% face-to-face? I guess I'm just trying to figure that out.
Yeah, good question. Our program is pretty standard. We are APA accredited, and APSIN, the neuropsychology organization, has approved us as well. Neuropsychology fellowships require extensive formal training in addition to the neuropsychological testing, which all of our fellows do their own testing. We don't use psychometrists. Report writing, and there's also a research component. So we're pretty standard and meet all of those formal guidelines.
Okay, so I think it sounds like we have questions or concerns. The question is, do we want to take it to the board with the idea that we have staff do some research on what other states are doing, knowing that we want to just have that conversation and bring it to light to the board? Or do we want to wait until we get some information from staff to kind of make, Dr. Meyer?
Yeah, I'm in agreement with Mr. Dinar to do it a bit more research, because the a lot of the neuropsych residencies are done in VAs, and to have the APA approved residencies and the neuropsych approval, that's the gold standard. So this is if students coming out of the Phoenix VA are having issues, then I would say the problem is with us, not their program. So figuring out what other states are doing, how this is being written, but also if we could go back and look at those applications that were denied because of this, I think is really important.
Do you want the item brought back to us first, or do we want to take it?
I think us.
Okay. All right. So is everybody in favor? Do we need to vote on this? Can we do consensus? Yeah. Okay. So let's do that. And then offline, Ms. Archibald, can you get hold of, or Heidi, or can we reach out to Ms. Archibald, Dr. Archibald, and find out who those students were? I don't want to do it right now because this is a public meeting.
Yes, please. We'll follow up with that. And I will do the poll of the other states.
Okay, perfect. Thank you, Dr. Archibald, for being with us today.
Bushnell,
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I'm looking at the wrong name, Bushnell. All right, sorry. All right, Ms. Packing on.
Yes, I'm moving on to line 5 at 32.2071.01. Staff is suggesting the committee consider whether to include Canadian Psychological Association accredited programs to the list of acceptable preparatory programs for clinical psychology. It is our understanding that the standards are at least as equivalent to that of the APA's. And what I had learned at one point, just in an unrelated conversation with ASPPB's Director of Educational Affairs, that CPA standards in some instances exceed that of APA's. So we're just raising the question to this committee.
Do the other states accept it or acknowledge it?
Madam Chair, I don't know. I haven't researched that issue. If I had to guess, there's been some polling, but if the polling is dated, I can do another, you know, an updated poll and see what states are accepting CPA accreditation.
I wouldn't have a problem moving it to the board, but I would like to get that information when we are at that board meeting. That's my thoughts. Mr. Diner or Dr. Meyer?
I agree, Ms. Shreve. I mean, it seems like it's equivalent.
Okay, is that Dr. Meyer?
I don't see an issue with just get the numbers of other states that are doing this, but even if not many are, internships are synced between APA and CPA. So we've really kind of tried to merge the Canadian practice with the US. So I don't see any issue with this. As we saw at the last meeting, APA is acknowledged CPA as being equivalent. So I think even if we, I mean, makes sense to be as standard as possible across the U.S., but even if not a lot of states are doing this, I don't see a problem with adding that equivalency.
I think I'm seeing a consensus of head noddings. We'll move it forward. And if we just get that information, that would be great on the other states.
All right, good, Madam Chair. And just to remind everyone, of course, Canadian psychologists are also required to take the ECCC, pass the ECCC. So there's some standardization in that respect.
And that's good to let everybody know too when we go to the board. All right, next item.
Okay, so at 32.2071, oh, hold on, and 32.2071.01 subsection D, we are suggesting that the board allow applicants who possess the HSP, ABPP, and CPQ credentials to supply evidence of that credential when applying for exam licensure by exam. That in this recommendation reflects, I think, an effort or an intention to really create more of a reciprocity or an endorsement to fully expand on that pathway. So we do have a separate subsection that allows those credentials to meet licensure requirements, but we don't carry that over to the application that is specific to exam and or licensure. So there's sort of a little bit of inconsistency there. And I don't think that it was ever intentional. Dr. Meyer, are you able to sort of, are you understanding this and are you able to articulate this better than I am?
So, yeah, I ran into this, when I was looking to move to Arizona, I had just hit 5 years of licensure, mm-hmm. and I have the health service psychologist credential. Mm-hmm. And I want to say, do you have to be licensed? Yeah, I don't know why there was the distinction, because I think it was for the health service psychologists and not for ABPP or CPQ. What's the 5-year requirement for? Is it for all of them?
For licensure by waiver.
Right.
Right.
There's something about 5 years for the national register one.
Madam Chair, committee members, that is the case in 32-2071.01. When you look, I think it's subsection D, when it lists ABPP and CPQ, and then when it lists the National Register, it does add the and 5 years of licensure.
And I don't know why that is there. And further, I think with the universal recognition being in place now and the push for reciprocity, I think the easier we can make it for reciprocity, the better. I think it's sad that all you need is a license versus having these established reciprocity organizations for psychologists, and it's harder with that than it is just to have a license. Doesn't make any sense now that we've moved to universal recognition.
So, Madam Chair, Dr. Meyer, are you suggesting that maybe a different way of resolving this would be to remove the 5-year requirement and just, I mean, if once the ink is dry on your credential, you can apply for licensure here by reciprocity, essentially?
That would be my recommendation, is because to get one of these credentials, it's more work. Well, the board certification is a lot more work, but the other two are just as much or more work than applying for a license. So they verify all of the material and say you meet these standards, which are equivalent to our state standards. So I don't see an issue with, if they've got one of these credentials, that should be is the easiest route for reciprocity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Madam Chair, Dr. Meyer, I see that as, I mean, there's a couple of different ways that we could allow this application pathway to be opened. But what the one you're describing, eliminating the 5-year requirement, to me seems to be the easiest and most clear way to do this. So
what is it that they don't have that we would require?
Nothing.
Okay. That's I mean, I don't, okay. So they would have everything.
Well, so I don't know about CPQ. I know that for National Register and board certification, those requirements are the same as or more stringent. I just don't have any experience with CPQ. I would assume it's the same, but I don't know. So I want to be careful about that.
Mr. Dinar, you're on mute. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with Dr. Meyer's suggestion. I just wanted to say that it's like there are like two different statutes that this thing is pointing to. And essentially, I mean, you're looking at, so even if you have the CPQ or ABPP accreditation, you still need to meet our 3,000 hours of supervised professional work experience, et cetera. That's like 2071 subsection D. So I guess, I mean, in terms of reciprocity, we are essentially saying remove the 5-year requirement. So if you, once you have, like Ms. Packman was saying, the ink is dry on your CPQ or whatever, you apply to us, you still have to show 3,000 hours of supervised professional work experience, supervised pre-internship professional experience, additional internship, and supervised postdoctoral experiences as described in subsection G. Am I reading that right?
Mm-hmm. But
so I guess, I mean, that makes sense to me.
But the point of having the reciprocity is that you don't have to, once you have those degrees or certifications, you don't have to go back and prove anything anymore. They've already verified that for you. And mm-hmm. all three of those require postdoctoral hours and don't count pre-internship hours. So it's actually more, requires more training than what Arizona does.
So then what you're saying, Dr. Meyer, is the initial wording of 2071.01 subsection D says an applicant for licensure who is licensed to practice psychology at an independent level in U.S. or Canada meets the requirements of subsection A, paragraph 1 of this section. We need to also think about amending that potentially, because subsection A, paragraph one, says you have to meet 2071 subsection D. And 2071 subsection D is the 3,000 hour requirement.
Or subsection D. 2071.01A1 says meet the education requirements of 2071 or subsection D of this section.
So one of the other.
Yeah. So, I mean, the point is 2071 has subsection D, which is a different subsection D than this or subsection D that talks about the 3,000 hours. So if you just go to 2071 and scroll down to subsection D, it is saying all of these 3,000 hours in all of these categories.
Right, but you have to have that to get one of these credentials.
But that's up to those credentialing bodies, right? So that credentialing body has just, I mean, it just happens to be the case that they have made it 3,000, but let's say they had 2,000 or 4,000. What I'm hearing in terms of reciprocity is, then why are we having the 3,000 requirement? So if, let's say, if this one of these three credentialing bodies had 2,000 hours required training, because of the way it is written right now, that person will have to come to us and show an additional 1,000 hours to get licensed in Arizona.
But we don't do that for universal recognition.
That's exactly my point. That's my point. We don't do it for universal recognition. So if we agree with Dr. Meyer's initial proposal to take out the 5-year requirement, the way to sort of synchronize this with all of the other reciprocity provisions or universal recognition provisions that we have would be to think about, do we want the 2071.01 subsection D to point to 2071 requirements?
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, committee members, if I may, this was originally my suggestion because we have the credential application, which is the embodiment of 32-2071.01, in that if they have one of these credentials and they've been licensed and with the National Register licensed for 5 years, they do not have to verify any supervised experience or education. We don't request transcripts. We don't request verifications for the supervised experiences. The credential supports that. And the only one that requires the ECCC transfer is the National Register. I think when this law was made, that the National Register did not verify ECCC scores. And so we required that. My thought was that, and I've had applicants ask, will we accept their banked credentials from the accrediting bodies? Like if they have the National Register, but they've only been licensed a year, they have to submit the exam and licensure application, exam and or licensure under a waiver. And what they wanted to know was, you know, I've banked my credentials with National Register, or I've banked my credentials with CPQ, with ABPP, with ABPP. Can I use that credential to serve as my proof of having, for the 2071 requirements, since that credential has already verified all of it? So it was partly in my mind was about where, as a board, the board is encouraging psychologists to bank their credentials, yet our statutes and rules don't allow us to accept them except in very specific circumstances. And so that's part of where I was going with this one, wasn't so much to establish a new reciprocity or change the 5-year rule, but just to allow applicants for exam and or licensure to use their credential, CPQ, ABPP, or National Register, as in lieu of verification of education and training.
And that makes sense, it should just be, if you have this credential, the we've already said we take these for waiver, that should cover everything. Not like, if you have that, it should be as simple as the universal recognition. Now that we have that, but I am curious as to why it's 5 years. The 5 years is only for the National Register. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why that is. But anyway, I would say whatever Ms. Folks just said, that people don't have to verify anything, because that's a, other than they have their credential, because those are kind of already established as standards across the U.S. for reciprocity. And once you have that, then you're good. Now, does the National Register still not verify ECCC scores?
Madam Chair, Dr. Meyer, I'd need to do a little research. I need to look that up.
Because we'd need to make sure. I don't know why. It probably would be good to compare the three and make sure that they are in line, but I don't see why they need to, why this needs to point to any other rules, as long as they meet our requirements. Mr. Dinar, are you okay with that?
Yeah, that's where I was going. Yeah, thank you, Dr. Meyer. You said it better than I could.
All right. So are we all in agreement then, and consensus, we're going to move this to the board, and then with the idea that Kathy's going to do that research?
I have one other suggestion as far as 2071.01D3 relating to ABAP. They're no longer referred to as diplomates, but as specialists. So as a specialist, not that that's a significant, but
might as well clean it up while we're working on it. Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members, I've pulled up the credentialing requirements for the National Register, and it does state that a passing score on the ECCC is a requirement now.
Do we all have the same passing score? Do all the states? I mean, everybody have the same? Okay, just wanted to confirm that. All right, so we're going to move this forward. I feel there's a consensus. I see heads nodding. All right. Thank you. Next item.
Okay, Madam Chair, line 7, please open 32.2072C, because that statute, that subsection states, sorry, page loading slowly, an applicant may not take the ECCC until the applicant completes the education requirements of this article. So that compels us to jump back to 2071, is it 0.01? Hold on. So yes, 2071 describes that the education requirements are the completed doctoral program, plus the dissertation internships. Basically, what we're trying to achieve here is that if we change the language in 2072 subsection C to indicate that an examination can be taken prior to completing the required internship and dissertation, what that means is that someone who is intending on applying for licensure, once they complete the coursework, they can elect at that time to take part one of the ECCC. It's called early entry. This has been a topic that has been raised both in the with stakeholder groups, APA chapters, and it has been discussed by Dr. Malott, our liaison to ASPA, and myself. We've met to discuss this issue, and everyone, there's a consensus that this is a great idea. It's a personal election to take the examination part one at that time, rather than having to wait until internship and dissertation are completed. So what that achieves is that the candidate may have a more successful experience, be more likely to pass taking the examinations closer to when they finished the didactic portion of their program. And then they can prepare for part two as they are completing the other requirements. We weren't sure what ASPPB thought of this idea, but they are very much on board. What they would love to see is that the jurisdictions permit this. And again, it's a personal election. A candidate may decide to wait until after all educational requirements are complete, but giving them this option may be, it may give candidates a better chance at success in passing part one early. Plus, it also it helps with the fiscal impact of the cost of testing. So if they're testing part one, and then it's some time into the future before they test for part two, then that's a benefit as well. So this is a topic that was that has been discussed at ASPPB's ECCC part two town hall meetings. And at least the group that I was in, very enthusiastic about this idea.
I think it's a great idea, especially if you get out of school, take that test. Mr. Dinar?
Yeah, I agree. It's a great idea. I was just, when Ms. Packman was describing this, I was thinking of how the University of Arizona Law School was promoting the idea that students in the last semester of law school should be able to take the licensing exam in Arizona. Mm-hmm. And that measure was adopted by the Arizona Supreme Court. So we have in Arizona the similar situation for law students. And I'm a big fan of that, that, you know, students can take the exam in the February of their last semester of law school and they get their results in May or June. And, you know, that just de-stresses them, gives them the confidence necessary to go into a clerkship or an internship right after law school. So I'm very much in favor of this proposal.
Dr. Meyer?
Yeah, it's moving in line with medical doctors as well. With the addition of part two and separating out the more of the applied concepts, it makes sense. And I thought ASPPB was pushing for this approach as opposed to just being enthusiastic about it. So I it makes sense now that we've adopted part two. It makes more sense to allow part one only to occur prior to completion of the degree. Part two should, and so I think we just need to specify that part two is after they've completed internship.
All right, so I think I see a consensus. So this one's moving forward with our support. All right, next item.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think the talking points to that one, they practically write themselves. So I think about, you know, how to sell this to legislators. I think that they will be very much in support of this potential change. And I know we'll have ASPA's behind us. So moving on to 2073, Ms. Folks and I occasionally will lament the fact that our temporary license holders they're not prescribed a specific title that they are to use to represent themselves and their relationship, their role in the service delivery system. Stakeholders have also raised questions, including the temporary license holders themselves. What am I to call myself? How am I to refer to myself? You've seen a few cases too, where I think certain individuals, maybe they weren't temporary license holders, maybe their temporary license had lapsed. I don't recall all the facts and circumstances, but there's definitely there's an opportunity for misrepresentation to occur where a person who isn't yet a licensed psychologist could be confused or construed to be or they could mislead someone in that direction. I hope that's clear.
So junior psychologists?
So the master's level Board of Behavioral Health Examiners, they use associate. So it's like a licensed associate counselor. So licensed associate psychologist would be consistent with what's also in the mental health field.
Mr. Diner, is there a term they use for junior attorneys? Or are you a temporary licensed attorney?
Well, I haven't seen a temporary licensed attorney. I've just seen a pro hoc vice attorney, but that's a very inside baseball thing. I mean, I wouldn't recommend PhD, whatever. But
you think they're known as grunts.
I like associate. I think
associate that works, I guess. Yeah.
I mean, are you looking for suggestions for us? I guess I say we take it to the board with the idea of associate. I mean, the board's going to obviously have their own conversation. Is everybody in consensus with that? All right. We'll hear what our other board members think.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I think the term associate is, I think it's generally recognized to mean something less than, you know, a fully licensed professional. The only other term that occurred to me was maybe technician, but I don't think that that's really that. I don't think that one's better.
Madam Chair, committee members, if I may, the when I see verifications coming through, it across the board, psychologist associate or associate psychologist is very standard throughout the country.
Okay. Good. No, thanks. All right, next item.
Yes, Madam Chair. So 32-2075, that statute prescribes the instances where a person can practice under certain licensure exemptions. And we spent a lot of time looking at 2075A1 as it relates to exempting school psychologists. But if you remember when we were sort of diving into all of the edits that were made to the statute under House Bill 2178, there was some changes that legislative council made to that subsection A6 that they intended to be to conform with, you know, whatever writing style guide legislative council applies. But there was some discussion about how those edits really change the meaning of that subsection and in a problematic way. I remember particularly Dr. Davey finding those edits and speaking to them. So it's unfortunate he's not here. Dr. Meyer, do you remember any of that conversation?
I have no idea.
Actually, I remember it because I was in favor of what Dr. Davey was saying.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the problem is that the legislature changed is to has been.
Yes.
So what that means is someone who was a psychologist, who is no longer a psychologist, could still be a supervisor because that person has been a psychologist at some point in the past. So the change from is to has been is substantive, is what Dr. Davey was saying. And I kind of see his point. I mean, yeah, why do we change it to has been? I mean, maybe it's like the rules committee or whoever the rules attorneys are at the legislature thought maybe that's like the better way of saying it. But I'm sure that they did not mean to suggest that a non-psychologist who was at some point a psychologist can still be a supervisor to a supervisee. I mean, it just...
Right.
So it says if the services or activities are provided under the direct supervision of a licensed psychologist who has been licensed or certified for at least 2 years, doesn't that sound like they have to be a licensed psychologist now?
Yeah, that's how I read it.
So if you click on the link that she has in the, which thanks Heidi for all the links. Mm-hmm. It pops up the House bill and you can see the edits. It's section 6. If Mr. Diner, if I'm reading the right section that you're referring to.
Right. It's the same one. So it says direct supervision of a licensed psychologist who has been licensed or certified for at least 2 years. So I think Dr. Davis' question was, so are we talking of a current licensed psychologist? Because it's not an or an and sort of a provision. Yeah. It says a licensed psychologist who has mm-hmm. been licensed.
But you can't be a licensed psychologist without that being active. The has been only applies to the time frame. It says
right.
provided under direct supervision of a licensed psychologist.
Who has been.
And then it's who has been licensed for at least 2 years.
It's almost like two phrases.
And that's... who is competent in the areas of professional practice. So I think the licensed psychologist, the starting point of that, of a licensed psychologist, addresses what we need. I agree that the has been makes it a little bit more confusing, but you can't be a licensed psychologist if you're not, don't have a current and active license.
And if we think that it could be clearer with the word is, I mean, I'm good with this too. I mean, I don't think it's whatever. Well, but
this is, we didn't do this, right?
Right. But can we still comment on it though? I mean, is that what?
Madam Chair, what I would suggest is that anticipating that there will be substantive changes that we are going to request, we could ask Legislative Council to, you know, revisit this edit that they made and explain that this could be construed in at least two different ways. To Dr. Meyer's point, I think we're absolutely on solid ground to interpret this subsection the same way that we always have. This edit did raise some questions about is this a new meaning or a new interpretation that wasn't intended? So we can at least do that much. We may decide we don't want to die on this hill, particularly if legislative council says, no, you know, this is conforming to our style requirements. We can all agree that we want to and need to and can interpret it the same way we always have.
I don't think it hurts to ask, right? What's the worst they're going to say is no. So do we need to take this to the board to ask, or can we just say, can we ask? What's the time frame on this?
You know, we can just include it as part of the whole discussion, the package of the discussion. So, you know, my notes will reflect that we don't see this as hugely problematic, but can we revisit this?
All right, perfect. All right, so I think that's a consensus with everyone. Mm-hmm. All right, moving to the next item.
Thank you. Line 10, 32-20-81. Ms. Michelson and I, when we were at the ASPPB mid-year meeting, we found ourselves in a conversation with a psychologist board member from Rhode Island. And he described what I thought was a very intriguing corrective action or remediation strategy, which I copied the language entirely from their statute, which gives the board the discretion to dismiss or suspend a complaint without a finding. So the subject of the complaint, the respondent, may participate in a colleague assisted program. I'm going to call that mentorship, that's acceptable to the board. So this intrigues me in particular because we know that the one strategy that we have that I think is similar is the order for non-disciplinary continuing education. Continuing education, though, we know that it doesn't, just because you sat, you know, for 12 hours in a seat or took a course online, it doesn't make you any more competent. But something like what this is describing, which, again, I'll call it as mentorship, there's a higher level of engagement and there's a greater opportunity for that program to involve performance objectives that are of a higher level. So in my mind, this kind of remediation strategy or corrective action strategy could have a greater impact on changing behaviors than ordering non-disciplinary CE.
And it would not be reportable?
Correct.
Is that the idea? Is that if we found it, that it's not an egregious violation, that it's something we just want them to maybe get some mentorship on, then we
wouldn't. Exactly.
We can't do mentorship with a non-disciplinary, can we?
You could get a licensee to agree to pretty much anything in a consent agreement. So you could craft something like this in a consent agreement where, you know, you tell the licensee, look, you're on the borderline here. So can we agree that you would benefit from, you know, some hands-on attention, you know, some one-on-one with someone who, you know, is an expert in this, that, or the other. Sure, you could always do it that way. But I think having the statutory authority to say, time out, we really don't see a violation here. We think you need retraining. And the best possible way to do that is under the leadership of someone who is truly there to observe your behavior, determine if you are meeting milestones and objectives within time frames. To me, this is so much more powerful than go do 12 hours of CE.
But if we do a consent agreement, doesn't that go on their record?
No.
Calvin, is that reportable?
Well, it's a public document. What I'm hearing from Heidi is that it would only be in cases where we haven't found a violation.
Right.
But if we haven't found a violation, then what's our right to give them any guidance? Are we kind of threatening them in some ways? Like, hey, you can do this, or we're going to take it this way. I mean, is that not threatening? I mean, that's the right word, but, you know, encouraging or...
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I view it kind of as like a diversion program. Okay. But in a diversion program, you have committed an offense, and it's a way to maybe expunge or dismiss the offense once you complete the terms.
Mm-hmm. Galvin, do you see any legal complications or any precedent? I mean, what are your thoughts on, I mean, as far as from a legal perspective? You've been with us a long time.
I think we would... I would have concerns that it's reserved only for instances where there's no violation. If you don't believe that the psychologist has committed any violations, then what is the point to have this diversion type of program? I think that there would have to be rules that would follow this statutory implementation as far as, you know, setting out the matrix and the requirements in a rule. Otherwise, I could see that application and implementation could vary as the board members change. And I think it could be subject to, you know, an abuse of discretion if there weren't rules that would firm it up.
Thank you, Dr. Meyer.
Yeah, I love the idea of having a diversion program or something that's perhaps more effective than CEUs, but I was concerned about the same thing that Ms. Galvin just said, that I think everybody that we found a violation of or required them to do anything would be comparing their case to any other case that we did this diversion program for. I think it'd be really hard to apply this in a standard manner.
Everyone would be vying for this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it unique to Rhode Island?
Madam Chair, Ms. Galvin, I've never heard of this before in my 20 plus years of being a regulator. And truly the way I see it is, this is an indelicate way of describing it, but it is the non-disciplinary CE order enhanced on speed, if you will. It is a way more effective strategy than ordering someone to do CE because they're ordered instead to be mentored.
I guess for me, if you get to the point where you need someone mentoring you, then something went wrong. And I'm not sure how that would work. I could think we'd need more information from Rhode Island. You know, how do they apply it? Does anyone else apply it? Have they had any suits, you know, because of it? I'm not sure. To me, once you've identified a problem, because we've only done CE units credits if it's a minor slap on the hand. I mean, if we're talking someone needs mentoring, then I think we've crossed a line somewhere of behavior. Mr. Dinar, thoughts?
So I think, I mean, I'm understanding Ms. Pakkanen's sort of idea of why this can be a good tool to have as a board. I mean, I'm thinking in terms of, you know, we sometimes do practice monitoring, and mentoring is sort of a lesser version of that. And mentoring, you know, may be more beneficial than CE, and sometimes more beneficial than practice monitoring. So, I mean, I guess I'm leaning toward this is a good tool to have. I mean, yeah, I mean, you know, we'll of course have cases where, you know, it's recommended on the agenda to do disciplinary, but board members might find mitigating factors, or the licensees attorneys would say, oh, hey, you know, do a letter of concern. I mean, that's always going to be the case in every case. So I guess, I mean, in terms of the kind of tools that the board has to protect the public or to make sure that the licensees or whatever problems they have are remediated or rehabilitated. I mean, part of our job is punishment sometimes, but part of our job is also rehabilitation, helping them in their profession to achieve success. And I think this is a good tool to, you know, achieve some of those results in some of the cases that we see.
I guess where I saw this potentially being the most constructive would be with documentation concerns. So board receives a complaint alleging, you know, perhaps something about substandard care. Board determines there's no finding with respect to that, but the documentation is really kind of problematic. But it doesn't, the concern doesn't rise to the level of, you know, a finding of a violation of substandard documentation, but mentoring with a colleague could make all the difference in terms of how the documentation is organized and structured and those kinds of, you know, just working through a list of best practices, standards and criteria for maintaining patient documentation or client documentation. That's where I thought this could be particularly useful. A CE course, sure, I can sit in front of a computer for 4 hours and sort of see that instruction about how I could do better with my documentation. But working with a mentor, that would probably teach me a lot more and give me feedback too.
Dr. Meyer?
I see this as making Ms. Galvin's job much more difficult, because we already have the cases where you're recommending here's what you should do, and then we get all well, but do we really want to? Do we really have to report this? Can we just do all the things what we'd want to do except for reporting it? And it would keep going to this. I think in the where I see CEUs not being effective is in applying evidence-based practice to your clinical work. If I have, I would hope that a doctoral level person can say, okay, here's a list of best practices for documentation that I get from CEU training and then apply those. That there's not a lot of critical thinking skills or change in practice other than, okay, I have to make sure I now include the dates and the times and a bit more information. I think this would blur into where we need to be finding a violation, but we just don't want to. And so again, it becomes this arbitrary thing that would be really hard to standardize. I love the idea of having more options and more measured options. It's just, I think this would take a lot of work to outline a program like this with very specific criteria. So I almost kind of think, worth further exploration, but not something to pursue right now until we've gotten every bit of material and guidance from Rhode Island and seen if there right. anybody else is doing something like this. And I love the idea. I just think we need a lot more groundwork for it.
I think what I'm hearing is there's an interest in it and that, you know, having a further conversation, but I think finding out exactly how they're implementing it Do they have a matrix? How have they implemented it? Maybe examples of how they've implemented it and any legal repercussions from it, I think would be important. So can we gather that information maybe and then bring it back to our committee? Is that okay? I'm seeing a consensus. All right. Thank you. Yeah, it's kind of intriguing, but it's like, how do we do it?
I think it's doable and I do think it's appealing.
Yeah.
But I think we need more than, you know.
I think before we take it to the board, we need to have a little bit more succinct on how it would be applied. Because I think the conversation would be, you know, very difficult. All right, we're getting close to the end there.
Okay, thanks, Madam Chair. This one could be hopefully a softball. Only statute that we've captured for purposes of this discussion or starting this discussion is for BAs is 32-20-91. So at one point in time, I'm sure it made sense to define behavior analysis in part by what it does not include. So if you go to that link, it has a sentence which specifies what behavior analysis isn't. And the CBA has had some discussion about this. So it does not include cognitive therapy, psychological testing, and so forth and so forth. So basically, it doesn't include, it's not psychology. We understand that. So the CBA, at least in the past year, maybe 18 months, they've had some conversation around really, do we still need to define behavior analysis in part, at least in part in this way? Can't we say that after more than a decade of regulating this profession and this not being an issue from a regulatory standpoint, do we even need that sentence? And Dr. Davey, he could speak more and he's much more informed than I am, but he has looked into this and this is a rarity to define a practice, a type of practice by what it is not. And I haven't looked at all of the other practice acts to see, you know, is occupational therapy defined by what it isn't? Is medicine defined by what it isn't? Chiropractic and so forth. So
whether or not they come up with a solution.
I think I hear some background.
So
Mr. Diner, or yes, I saw both hands. I'm sorry.
So I understand the concern for, you know, saying means XYZ and then does not include ABC. I mean, my sense is the little bit of research that I've done in this, and again, this committee doesn't have a behavioral analyst member to give us any additional insights, but it seems like this, when the behavior analysis statutes were written for the first time, so in 2008, this definition has been there. So the very first time that they created the definition, they said behavior analysis means blah, blah, blah. Behavior analysis does not include blah, blah, blah. And that hasn't changed. So I just wonder why now we need to take a look at this. I mean, is there like anything specific that has occurred in recent years? Because this statute was touched again in 2009. So 2008 was when it was enacted. And 2009, it was again sort of amended. And in that amendment, they did not change the does not include language. And after that, no one has touched the statute at the legislature. So, I mean, unless like there is like a pressing need to delete that, I mean, that's how we are defining behavior analysts in the state. I mean, that's a very fundamental sort of important thing that the statute has done. So I don't know. I mean, unless there's like a very strong reason to go and look at it, I would just leave it as it is.
Thank you. Dr. Myers.
My guess would be is that that language is included to get psychologists to buy into bringing this license into existence. And I've run into ASU has an ABA program And every behavior analyst I've run across is doing cognitive therapy. I mean, there's already some crossover. They're doing evaluations. they're doing psychotherapy. So I do wonder about the level of creep that's already occurred and how much more would occur to get rid of that. That being said, I don't think we can have a good discussion on this without Dr. Davey here to give the other side of it. Cause I think I agree. Well, no, I think there are other statutes that say what you can't do. I mean, there's all the chiropractors and dentists have things that say what they can't do. Nobody says medical doctors can't do anything, but they can rule the world. But there are some limitations. You also see that the Board of Behavioral Health Examiners saying that they can't do psychotherapy, or I mean, psychological assessment. So there's very little anymore that uniquely defines psychologists, and everybody wants to carve out their territory and make themselves unique. I think that a change like this needs to have not only public comment, but probably feedback or what, I'm struggling with words at this point, that we reach out to the AZPA and get guidance from the field of psychology, because this is definitely going to lead to additional creep into the field of psychology. And I mean, at this point, do we care? All the other master's level licenses are doing that too. But just something to consider.
Okay, so Mr. Diner.
Sorry. Yeah, I mean, I think, I mean, as I said, like, if we have a very strong reason to touch it, like, yeah, we'll touch it, but I'm not hearing any. And instead, what I'm hearing is if we touch this, we are going to have a very robust group of stakeholders who are going to be either supportive or in opposition to this. So, yeah, I mean,
all right, so
let's not touch it.
All right, we're just going to let it flow.
Also, just to kind of like respond to Dr. Meyer's discussion about, you know, there are many professions that have the includes and then does not include sort of tiers. So, for example, as sort of on the dental board, they have four separate licenses. The topmost is the dentist, who they can do everything in the Dental Practice Act. And underneath that is, you know, the other three licenses, and they are defined like this, like you cannot do blah, blah, blah. And then the lower license, oh, you also cannot do blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, that's pretty standard. So it's not unique in terms of behavior analysis. But.
Okay. And I would see, and Adi, if you remove that, I mean, what's the legislative history going to show is that, well, does that mean they have now permission to do that? And could that be read, Heidi, as like increasing their scope? So then you have to do like a sunrise type of thing, even though that's not the intention. Okay. I think a lot could be right into that.
That's a good point.
So I'm hearing a consensus that we just let it lay, just we'll keep it the same.
Dr. Davey brought this, right? I mean, we need to hear from.
Did he bring this forward, Heidi, or was that?
All right, the CBA has had some discussions. They've stopped short of saying, I mean, they've reiterated a lot of what you've said. They've made some other points as well. And it was long enough ago that they determined there would be no recommendation to this board to change it at that time. So I've maintained this topic on the rolling list. And so that's why you're seeing it. But the CBA has not discussed it for easily a year, closer to 18 months.
All right. So do we want to then table it possibly until the next meeting? And if when we're all present, then we can just have a discussion about it. Dr. Davies is with us. Does that work with everybody? All right, I see a consensus. All right, we've been at it for almost 2 hours. Do we want a break or are we good? We got Mr. Diner, I can't hear you.
Let's do a break, I was saying.
All right, let's do like a 10-minute break. We'll be back here like at, 10:30. Does that work?
Yep.
All right, we'll see you then. Oh, I guess it's not 10:30 yet. Yeah, 30 seconds more to relax, and then we're back working.
Valley thing, it seems.
Oh, I hope it comes this way. We could use it. Mm-hmm. All right, it is 10:30. We are back in session for the Legislative and Rule Committee. And Ms. Pagan, you want to lead us through, I think it's the rules ideas? Mm-hmm.
Yes, Madam Chair. So click over to the rules tab. And just by way of reminder, we do have two pretty substantial rulemaking packages that are getting close to the finish line. They will be on GIRC's September 7th agenda. But as always, we find other things to talk about and consider. So one of them happens to be R-426-203.03. This is the rule that prescribes requirements for reapplication, reapplying, or applying anew. Kathy caught this. She noticed that this reference from A2 needs to be changed to A3. And Kathy, remind me what that's about. Oh, there is no A3.
Oh, sorry. I just was looking something up and realized it was referencing the wrong subsection.
So does it reference an A3, but there is no A3? Is that the issue?
I'd have to open it up.
It's at C5. I'm sorry. Okay, so the fee, all right, it references the fee in R-426-108. Okay, so let's put that on hold because that rule is changing dramatically anyway with the rulemaking package that I just described. I just realized that we need to let the dust settle on that change before we know how to correct the citation. Right. Ms. Galvin, in the meantime, is there a problem if a rule is clearly unequivocally describing a certain fee, but the citation is off to the actual fee in the other rule?
Like, are you prohibited from enforcing it?
Yeah.
No, I need to take a look, but no, if it's clear what the fee is, what fee you're referencing, the type of fee that you're referencing, that should not be a problem.
Okay. Thank you. So there's the other part to this, which is a suggestion
I didn't want you to move to the next item until I said something about this one. So long as it says reapplication fee, A2 or A3 shouldn't really matter. But also for the record, the A2 fee is $200 right now, and the A3 fee is also $200. So if the issue came up, it's like, oh, it's the same amount. So, what are you going to do? Like pay up the $200, I guess. But So I agree with everything you said. I just wanted to state that. Thank you.
No, thank you. And on our end, we would code that appropriately. So, but the question has been raised, and this is potentially, a parity issue. Should we consider eliminating the reapplication fee altogether? Because in the meantime, we have our temporary license holders, who we may be calling associates someday. They don't have to pay a fee to the board to retake the examination for permission or approval to retake the ACCP. So we kind of have maybe two divergent standards here. For purposes of processing a reapplication, there is some work involved in that we do sort of, there's a file to update. But as we move online, I would argue that work becomes, it diminishes. So I hope that's the case. I think it's the case. So do we need a fee to cover the cost of that?
How does it impact the budget? Aren't we self? We're an enterprise fund, aren't we?
Yes, Madam Chair. So I just saw our numbers for fiscal year 2022, and our fund is still growing. So we are not depleting our fund. We are collecting more money than we're spending.
I think, you know, we base it on what's right, but also I need to clearly understand. Are we going to be able to pay for you guys? Okay.
So what do we think about this?
Dr. Myers?
I mean, the presence of the fee or not is not going to change people reapplying. They've already invested so much to get this. They have to do it anyway. But it's just an extra burden for people that aren't being paid for a real position yet. So I don't see any problem with bringing it in line with the temporary holders and just reapplications are part of that initial application fee.
Madam Chair, can we ask Ms. Folks if she has a rough estimate, a guesstimate even, of how many reapps we receive in a year? It'll take me too long to pull that up.
Madam Chair, committee members, we seem to have two or three on each ARC agenda. I think I would guesstimate that. Additionally, I get emails from the applicants about the cost of taking the ACCC, and now they have the additional cost for part two. And that was one of my motivations for wanting to eliminate that fee, not only for the parity with the temporary license holders, but also to eliminate the burden on the applicant. And also we are, as a board, I believe we still need to reduce fees from what Heidi just said, that we're still collecting too much. So this would be an option to eliminate at least one fee. And it looks good to the public.
Yeah. Madam Chair, we won't miss the $7,200.
All right. Then are we in a consensus? Do we feel to move this forward with Mr. Dinar?
Madam Chair, so just two quick thoughts. I am always in favor of reducing fees, but I also understand sort of from an institutional perspective, once we eliminate a fee, it's very hard to institute the same fee. I mean, not just because we are a state agency, just any institution. It's going to be super hard to institute it. So just I recommend caution. Because it's easy to just say delete, and GRC is, of course, going to approve that. But yeah.
Well, Madam Chair, can I respond to that, which I think is an excellent point?
Yeah.
I am deliberately not recommending to this board to eliminate any authority in statute to do away with any specific fee. Let's leave the authority there. If the rules don't establish a fee, then we're clearly not intending to collect one. But to Mr. Dinar's point, if something happens, you know, like a fund sweep, and 5 years from now, we need to reinstitute the fee just to cover our cost of operating, we can do that. I will also say, too, that anytime a rulemaking package goes before GRC and there is a fee elimination, it's generally well received by GRC. So just the kinds of considerations to keep in mind.
Right. But in what Mr. Dinar said, if we wanted to reinstitute the fee, we still have to go back to GRC and get their blessing, though. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know how that, you know, how does that, you know, they're probably always happy to get rid of a fee, but getting a fee may be a little bit more of a challenge. So I just make sure we really look at that bottom line of how that's going to affect us. And Dr. Meyer?
Well, to build on what Ms. Folks said, I mean, less than a quarter of the applications we review are reapps, and probably less than 20%. But so it's not going to be a substantial portion of the fees that we're collecting.
All right. So do I see a consensus then? I think I'm hearing one to move this forward with the recommendation to maybe get rid of the fee, but see what it looks like. All right. Next item,
Excellent. So same rule, R426203.03, consider whether to revise the rule to clarify or make clear that school psychologists may submit letters of recommendation in support of an application. Bless you. So Dr. Meyer, I know that you were on the ARC rotation where this during which this is most recently discussed. And so ARC said, or maybe I said, well, let's let the Legislative and Rules Committee take this up.
Yeah, I think it needs to be licensed psychologists because that's what's required for supervision anyway. And it doesn't make sense to me to be having, I mean, recommendation letters don't do anything anyway. I mean, this has been discussed at ASPPB and CUDCUP. It's like, if you can't find a psychologist to write a recommendation letter, then there's something really wrong with you that would come out elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So it's just another hoop, but we don't accept it from master's level licensees, which might have a part in some site supervision. Like, it doesn't have to, like, somebody's supervision doesn't have to be 100% by a psychologist, but we still require the licensed psychologist to do that. So school psychology should be the same thing that shouldn't.
Is the issue that the rule says just psychologist and doesn't say licensed psychologist? What is the reasoning for that or for this?
Madam Chair, unfortunately, the language is, it could be cleaned up. It states that references must be psychologist licensed or certified to practice psychology in a United States or Canadian regulatory jurisdiction. So the term certified is what ARC has had some discussion around. What does that mean? Is that certified mean the Canadian term for regulation? I think we decided it wasn't. Does certified open the door to the school certified psychologists who are not licensed?
Have we actually had a problem?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
We have. Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, if...
And in some jurisdictions used to certify as mm-hmm. opposed to license, that I see this as outdated terminology that makes it more confusing now. Mm-hmm. That this is, the intent was practicing psychologists as we define it based on our license. And so if we just got rid of the word certified, I think that would clean it up and not change the intent.
All right. So is our recommendation then to move it forward and just leave it as take out certified? Which makes sense.
Correct. Yes. Okay. That takes care of the problem. I agree.
All right. Everybody's nodding. All right.
And I'm sorry, I'm going to flip these to go in the more logical order. Let's go to line 5, R426203, subsections C4 and 5. This relates to what Ms. Folks said earlier, which is, do we want to allow the ASPPB Credentials Bank to satisfy the requirements have been met for purposes of education and training to license someone. So in my mind, that was a rule change. I don't know if it also requires a statute change. I am really, really unclear about that. So I put it on this page because at the time, that's what made sense to me. Based on some of our earlier discussions this morning, maybe it needs to be in both places, in statute and in rule.
Because right now we're required to verify ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Galvin, do we need to change it in both? I mean, I think are we all in agreement that we'll accept the credential bank? So then it's just a matter of how do we best format that in rule and in statute. Is that what, Mr. Diner, you're on mute.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So I think, I mean, if the question is, what do we do first? I think the statutory change needs to happen first, because if we put it in the rule, then we are sort of creating a conflict between the statute and the rule. So maybe, I mean, the recommendation of the committee would be to forward this to the board with the recommendation that the statutes be amended to accept the credentials from ASPPB.
I agree. Dr. Meyer, are you good with that?
Yep.
All right. Okay. All right.
All right. So then let's go back up to line four. So R426207, that is the rule prescribing the requirements for continuing education. And Ms. Poe, I think, requested this item. So when a licensee who goes on inactive status and then later reactivates, what is their CE requirement? The rule isn't clear. We think, of course, the easiest way to address this would be to indicate you're responsible for the full 40 units as anyone else who is licensed, has an active license.
So if a person takes a year off or 2 years off and they jump back into the game, mm-hmm. we're saying that they should probably then have 40 for each year. They must, because it seems fair, because if you take a couple years off, and then, I mean, the idea is that you're staying on top of things, right? That's the whole purpose of education, is your mm-hmm. knowledge base. How do other states handle it? Do we know?
Madam Chair, that would be a good research project to take on. I guess that, because there is an active status application, so there's a transaction that happens. So that is the opportunity where we could say, okay, this is your application to go on an active status has been approved. Keep in mind that at any point when you reactivate, this is a requirement. So we put them on notice before they evaluate when to come back or when to apply to come back on active status.
So if you take 2 years off and you come back, I mean, it seems you just can't come back with no CEU credits. I mean, Dr. Meyer, you're the psychologist here. What do you think?
Well, does this typically happen at the time of renewal anyway? Like, or do people halfway through their, 1 year in, do people request inactive status? I just assumed it typically happens at renewal because there's no need to go in and say inactive, even if I'm not practicing. But I'm not sure what happens in real life.
I think we've had some people in the middle of a cycle seek inactive status, maybe for health reasons. They want to take themselves out of commission.
So it really, from my point of view, should really just be they would need the same amount of CEUs as if they had always been active.
Mm-hmm.
So if they've been out for, let's say a year into my license, I switch to inactive. And then when my license is up for renewal, can I just keep it inactive?
Mm-hmm.
Do I have to still pay the renewal fee?
I'm checking the statute, Dr. Meyer. Let me see. So we have a provision for place on inactive status and waive the renewal fee. That's not...
H, I think.
H, okay. I was on G. A psychologist on any form of inactive status shall renew every 2 years. So if they are inactive for medical reasons, if they are inactive because they are living in another state and they do not want to pay the $500 fee for the full license in Arizona because they don't anticipate practicing, that's what that allowance affords them.
CI, though, it says a psychologist on an active status may request reinstatement of the license to active status by applying to the board. The board shall determine whether the person has been or is in violation of any provisions of this chapter and whether the person has maintained and updated the person's professional knowledge and capability to practice as a psychologist.
Yeah, so that speaks to reentry. If the board has concerns, if someone has not been practicing for a decade, perhaps. So the board may require other knowledge or skill training experiences. Would you construe that to include continuing education? I hadn't thought about it that way.
Yeah, I think we may be overcomplicating this. I think it's just the same number of hours. We require 40 hours of CEUs every 2 years. I think if you've been inactive for 8 years, you need 160 hours to make your license go active.
Mr. Dinar?
So I'm thinking of like other licenses where we have similar things. I mean, I'm aware of the licenses of the dental board, and my personal license is an attorney license. So I think, I mean, when people go into inactive and come back to active, so you're essentially like a new licensee when you go back into active status. And for new licensees, so anytime, like imagine someone taking EEEE Part 1, Part 2, and then getting licensed for the first time, they don't have to come in with a 40-hour CE requirement. But in the first year of their practice, they have to start doing CEs. And I think that's the majority rule, is once you come back from inactive to active, in that first year, make sure you have your full active CEs. Now, we have 40 in a two-year period. So it could be the case that we could say, if you're on inactive status and you come back on active status, then complete 40 hours of continuing education in that first year of active practice. That would make sense because, yeah, we need to make sure you're competent, you know, you have the latest information to practice your profession, et cetera. But saying that, oh, you have been inactive for 8, 10, 12 years, and now we are asking you to do 200 hours. I mean, we don't know the circumstances of, you know, why they were inactive. It could be a very debilitating illness, injury. Like, it could be a number of reasons. I suspect we're going to see, like, some kind of, like, applications for, like, leniency or not even leniency. It's like, oh, like, can you exempt me from this because I have really good reasons why I couldn't take CE. That's why I went to inactive status to begin with. So I understand why we have continuing education for licensed professionals. It keeps people's knowledge updated to current levels, but it seems to me that requiring them to do everything, you know, 40 times 8 years that they were on inactive just feels too much. I would be fine with saying do the 40 hours in your first year of getting on the active status. That makes sense. So do in 1 year what other people do in 2 years. But also, I mean, there's the other consideration of how many years were you on inactive status. So if someone went on inactive status, you know, 6-7 months, and now they want to be back on active, they haven't done a full year of inactive. So maybe there's a way to say, okay, fine, do the 40 in 2 years, you'll be fine. But if someone has been on inactive status for more than 2 years, I'm leaning toward saying do 40 hours in 1 year, the first year that you become active.
I like that. Can we also find out, I think Mr. Dinar makes a good point of what the other professional associations require, mm-hmm. and also maybe check with some of the other states on what they require. But, you know, what is it in Arizona? Because I think there's I do agree. I mean, if you're gone for 10 years, you can't expect them to take, 40 hours for, like I said, it'd be five 200 hours or whatever it is, and then you come back in. But I think we want to be somewhat consistent with the other professional associations. But I do have concerns if you're out for 5 years and then you come back in, and even you take 40 hours the first year, have you is, and I don't know, Dr. Meyer, I mean, can you be out of the practice for a while where you're maybe, I mean, do you just get back on the bike and start riding and you're all good? I don't know. You know, I
the
mean,
sad thing
is there so much technology or, you know, stuff that changes?
The sad thing is that there's a huge problem between research and practice, that the majority of people, what they learn in grad school is what they do, and that rarely gets updated, or no matter how many CEUs you do, your practice doesn't change that much. And so it's, and that's a problem with the field, but requiring a whole bunch of CEUs is not likely going to change that. It really takes respecialization or retraining, which people don't do if they've just been out for a while. So, I really don't have a opinion. I'm really focused on, I'm fine with what Mr. Dinar said.
Yeah. I like that idea, Mr. Dinar, too, of if it's over 2 years and you do the 40 hours in the first year. So are we in consensus to move it forward? We can share Mr. Dinar's idea. And then to Ms. Pakaname, we can have some ideas of what, you know, other states or other Arizona professional associations are doing.
Yes, Madam Chair, absolutely. I'll do the research, and, you know, acknowledging this could take a couple of months. But what I think we want to do is we want to get past GIRC in September, and then sort of take a little breath before we do another rulemaking anyway. So we won't be rushing into this all that quickly, unless there's another reason to do it, of course. So, yeah.
All right.
And might I suggest that we flip-flop the last two items, because one of them is a much shorter discussion than the other one, I think. So rule, the only behavior analyst rule that made this list is R426-401 definitions. In the psychology rules, a day is defined as 8 hours. And that is important, because when you go back to the licensure exemption statute, that statute allows someone to practice in Arizona for 20 days without being licensed. So 20 days times 8 hours, as a day is defined in psychology, equals 160 hours. Behavior analysts are not, their formula is different. So they also have a 20-day licensure exemption, but their day could be 30 minutes, 1 hour, 4 hours. There isn't a definition that says a day is defined the same way as it is in psychology. So again, it's a parity issue. So behavior analysts who want to practice under this exemption are much more restricted in the sense of time than a psychologist would be. So hopefully that's clear. So do we want to be consistent and define day for behavior analysts as 8 hours the same way that we do in psychology?
Dr. Myers?
I've really struggled with this as for practicing in other states during telepsych COVID. But so if I do one therapy session for an hour on a day and that's it, because I'm only seeing one client, does that count as a day? Or do I get to do 8 sessions over a course of 2 months, and now I've finally hit a day? That doesn't make sense to me. It seems like once you do any amount of time, then that counts as a day, and you can do up to 8 hours, mm-hmm. or 10 hours. I don't know. It's just like being able to add 8 sessions over 8 weeks up to say, okay, I've practiced for one day now. That I think that is not consistent with what the intent of the law is.
Mr. Dinar? No. Oh, one second.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, this is, a very interesting issue for me personally, because before I was a lawyer, I worked at Citibank, and this issue was the biggest issue in the banking industry. Because a day, was it a calendar day? Was it 24 hours? Was it business day? It was this huge giant mess because, you know, depending on that, banks either earn or lose interest. So it's, you know, millions of dollars on the line. About a year and a half, 2 years ago, the Arizona Supreme Court decided a case regarding what constitutes a day for taxing purposes of airlines. And they have an interesting discussion of what a day means. I mean, it could mean 2 hours, like Dr. Meyer said, you know, you work for 2 hours on one day and that's it. And then the calendar date changed. Different day, different new tax, right? So, I mean, it's a huge issue. I personally lean toward saying, I mean, I guess the intent of saying 20 days, at least in the psychology rules, was 20 times 8. So you are really working for 160 hours. We don't care if you worked 160 hours during 5 days. It's just humanly impossible, but we'll raise flags. But work 160 hours on this, and then you're good, right? So I guess, I mean, do we just change everything to hours because that just makes it more certain, more easy to implement, to enforce? Because day can really mean anything. So I guess what I'm trying to get at is what's the intent of this? So when we, in any of our rules, when we say day, are we suggesting a 5 hour day? Are we suggesting an 8 hour day? Like, what are we talking about, right? So just convert everything to hours, and I guess that solves the problem. Or define day, and then that gives rise to other problems. But
right, and Dr. Meyer.
Well, right, and for me, the point of this is to say, if you're just going to come temporarily work here, then we're going to make that pretty easy for you to do. But if you're doing ongoing work here, then you need to be licensed. And so if I'm seeing one client, two clients a week, then I can get a full over, I can do a full year, because that's only 50 weeks times two is 100 hours. So I could be practicing every week for the full year without getting licensed if we go by just total cumulative hours. And I don't think that's the intent of this. It's to say, I have my client that's leaving the state, but I want it for a couple weeks and I want to be able to touch base with them, then I can do this. Or if I'm a sports psychologist traveling with a team, I can come in for a game and practice, no big deal. But to be able to just do cumulative hours means I can be hopping across the border and seeing a few clients every week, which I think should require a license here. You need to know what's going on if you're going to be practicing here every week. But yes, I still don't know, like, if I start the clock by working on a day, do I only have 20 more days of doing practice, 20 more calendar days, and then I have to get licensed, or is it I get to count up my days? I have no idea.
So can you, is there a way to word it where you say no more than 160 hours within 20 days? Or, you know, so you say, okay, you have 160 hours, but here's your time frame to use those hours.
Well, I think what is the intent of this law? Is it to say
temporary?
So temporary, not minimal, right? Like, so the goal is to say this is a one-off, or you've got a couple weeks here that you're doing something, which would all suggest consecutive calendar days, versus I can, or just a day here and a day there. I don't know. We have students at ASU that we're working with, and then they go off to California primarily over the summer. And it's like, can I continue to work with them, or my students continue to work with them? This is temporary, but
it just doesn't make sense. So we just quit doing it because I don't want to get licensed in California. But but I think this means temporary. So
how do you define temporary? I think that's the key. I mean, I think that's like you said. So what if you had one patient, you met him every hour for a year? Do we care? I mean, do we care? Is that
that's
is that
minimal?
Is that minimal? Do we care? Or do we care that, boy, maybe what's the point? We want that one patient to get a psychologist in that state. So I guess it's like, what is the intent? Is it short?
Right. Our job is to protect the public. If I'm just doing minimal work, if I'm seeing a couple Arizonans, I'm licensed in California, but I'm seeing a couple of Arizonans, and since I'm only working with two or three, I can have three weekly clients and still be under the 160 hours, work with them for the full year. I think to protect those three Arizonans, we need to be able to, regulate that practice versus, the sports psychologists traveling with the, Seattle Seahawks who need lots of mental help, then that makes sense to be able to practice temporarily and be gone. They're here for one game, a year. That shouldn't require a license. It's still their normal state's clients. So I don't know, but this is very confusing. I think it is complicated, and I'd love to have an answer. I don't know. I think the easiest way would be to say you've got, once you see somebody, you can continue for 20 days. If you exceed after that 20 days, then you've got to get licensed. But that seems overly restrictive. Yeah. So
Mr. Diner, if you're an attorney, can you practice in another state?
Well, Prahak Vijay takes care of it, but there's like a de minimis sort of thing. So if a client contacts you from another state in which you aren't licensed, you can't give them legal advice, but you can talk enough that, okay, let's have a lawyer-client relationship, and then I can do a PhD and all of that. But I guess, I mean, bottom line for our discussion is this is a super complicated issue. Mm-hmm. So I guess as a committee, we should definitely get the board's input on how, like Ms. Shreve's question, like at what point do we care about Arizona's public?
Right.
That we need to say that you need to be licensed. Right. So that's really the question. So I mean, it could come down to, you know, calendar days, just 20 days in a 9-month period, I don't know, or number of hours. There are different solutions, but it depends on what the board says, the threshold caring comes in, right?
And I think another element is we are more of a transitory society when we have we can do it over the like Zoom in or whatever. So it's confidential, whatever sites you use for that. But we have snowbirds. I mean, people come and go, you know, and so especially here in Arizona. So, I mean, how do we provide that service, like Dr. Meyer said, to our residents and not limit those that need it? So I think it's an interesting conversation. I think we get some ideas of what other states are doing and maybe even some other professional. I mean, we're kind of unique. Maybe doctors are the same. I don't know. Dr. Myers?
Well, I mean, no, because I've had the same issue with other states for me looking to do telepsych for our ASU students. So I don't think anybody really specifies, not that I've come across, it's very vague. And I think that with the addition of universal recognition, where we've pretty much said, if you're licensed somewhere else, you're good to go here.
That's a good point.
What again, back to the intent, what are we saying? And what are we trying to do? I guess with universal recognition, it's really easy to get licensed here now if you're licensed somewhere else. So should we be encouraging that route as opposed and just like get rid of this? But again, if you I think it just comes back to temporary and defining it in a pretty limited fashion. You've got, I don't know, but I think maybe a discussion from the board, but I think it's not going to come up with any other answers either. So, I mean, more of us are going to.
Madam Chair, committee members.
Yes.
I don't know if would you be interested in the board's reasoning in February of 2012 when this was first implemented?
Yep.
I pulled up the minutes and basically Chairman Wexler provided a summary to the board and described the telepractice committee's recommendations pertaining to 2075A4, specifically the definition of a day and a year. It is recommended that a year be defined as a calendar year, January 1st to December 31st. It is further recommended that a day be defined as any accumulation of 8 hours in the provision of psychological services, regardless of the number of calendar days over which the hours were accumulated. Further, this accumulation of hours includes work performed within Arizona as well as work performed outside of Arizona, e.g. report writing. Travel time is not considered a psychological service and is excluded from hours accumulated. Board members deliberated and confirmed that when applied, the recommended definition of a day would allow a psychologist from another jurisdiction to practice in Arizona up to 160 hours per year. Board members expressed concern that a psychologist could practice for 1 hour a day for 160 days. Board members deliberated the fact that the court system utilizes different experts from different jurisdictions for specific cases, which may support continuation of the statute. Board members indicated a statute change may be considered in the future to require a psychologist from a different jurisdiction to obtain a temporary slash provisional license to practice in Arizona. After deliberation, Dr. Malott made a motion seconded by Dr. DeBacco to approve the telepractice committee's interpretation of a year and a day. The motion carried unanimously. So apparently, same issues in 2012 as today.
Madam Chair, I think that's interesting history, but I think Dr. Meyer was really pointing out what examples of what has transpired since then. Universal recognition. 34 states have now joined SciPact. We will soon, I think, be launching, opening up the telehealth registry. So what made sense in 2012 may or may not make sense now. And definitely what this discussion is telling me is this isn't about a rule change. This is revisiting, I think, the statute and going back to that as a starting point. And then once the board determines what, if anything, to do about your statutory exemption language, then the next step, of course, is to address what how you want the rule to be, to implement this, how you're defining day, how you're defining year, if you're using those terms. So we need to go back to square one, and that's a bigger discussion.
Yeah, let's do some homework and come back to this issue. I mean, it's an interesting issue.
It's very interesting.
I'm very interested.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, committee members, I agree completely. I just wanted to give the historic perspective because I think it helps inform with the changes that need to be implemented now with the changes in our society and ability to practice and get a license.
And what's fascinating is they had the same discussion we did.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, exactly, almost verbatim, right? As far as here's what the scenarios could be. So,
but didn't we bring this up in regard to the behavior analysts, not the psychologists? So, is it worth changing to make them consistent when we don't know what we mean by it? So just leave it. Okay.
We want them to suffer as much as we do.
Excellent.
Why make it easy for them?
Exactly.
All right. So we are in consensus. We're going to move it to the board and have a discussion.
Yes. So the last item, of course, is the favorite topic for all concerned, which is whether to incorporate by reference the most current version of the APA ethical principles of psychologists and code of conduct. So.
Madam Chair, So I'm going to start by maybe something that I view as like a neutral way of looking at this. So in June of this year, so just a few weeks ago, the Arizona Supreme Court decided a case called Roberts versus Arizona. I get bragging rights because the U court decided the case unanimously, and they essentially copy-pasted my submission to the court. So I get bragging rights for that. But the issue was, thank you. The issue was incorporation by reference. And the court had very harsh things to say about boards incorporating things by reference. And so that I guess really should be the starting point for thinking about any place where we are incorporating a standard that is written by a private association. And yeah, we all like the American Psychological Association, et cetera, but they are still a private organization. They aren't a state agency, don't have the same checks and balances, et cetera. So they have written this ethical standard. And according to Roberts versus Arizona, we have to be very careful in adopting any standard written by a private organization like the APA. And that leads me to looking at ARS 41-1028. So 1028 is the, so again, for the record, 41-1028.
That's not part of psychology, right?
No, that's just general. Whenever a state agency is incorporating anything by reference, you have to comply with the Administrative Procedure Act. Okay. And in the Administrative Procedure Act, it says the reference in the agency, I'm reading subsection B, the reference in the agency rules shall fully identify the incorporated matter by location, date, and otherwise, and shall state that the rule does not include any later amendments or additions of the incorporated matter. And that's really why we are here, is because our rules say we adopted the 2010 version of the APA Ethics Code. And according to 1028, we have to say, it says shall state. So we had to state in the rules that no later amendments are part of the ethics code that the board has adopted. So that's why we are stuck with 2010. And anytime we change that, anytime APA comes up with a newer version, 2016, whatever you call it, we have to go through this. We have to still comply with the Administrative Procedure Act. And we still have to say it does not include anything beyond the revision date, because that's what 1028 subsection B says. So that's a roundabout way of me saying we have two regulations in front of us, the 306 and 406. So 306 is psychology and 406 is behavior analysis. And 406 says, in fulfilling its responsibilities under law, the board shall rely on the most current version. So in my view, 406 does not comply with 1028, because 1028 says you shall state that it does not include any later amendments. Whereas 406 is just automatically saying anytime there is a new amendment, it becomes part of our ethics code that the board has adopted and is going to enforce. So first of all, I mean, before going to the 306 discussion, I just want to state for purposes of our understanding and for us thinking about this issue that we need to go and amend 406 and say which version of the BACB code we have adopted. And the sort of corollary to that is the suggestion was that why don't we as a sort of compromise adopt language similar to the 406 language in 306. And my reasoning is the same. If 406 doesn't comply with 1028, then if we adopt that language in 306, then 306 is not going to comply with 1028 because we have to specify a certain version, and beyond that, we aren't adopting any other version. So that's sort of like the neutral reason for not touching 306. And obviously, the more controversial reason, I've stated this many times. Dr. Meyer, you and I agree on many things, but maybe on this one, we have to agree to disagree strongly. But I think that there are some serious problems in the 2016 version. And essentially, I mean, my thinking is because of the deletions that APA has done, those deletions is what makes their additions more problematic. Mm-hmm. So, and there's no way for us to say, oh, we sort of like go in and like just accept this phrase and not accept this phrase. It's just going to make things too complicated. So I continue to say this, and I'll say it again, let's not touch 306. 2010 works fine because it says a licensee who has come up with this kind of an issue where their APA ethics code recommends they resolve a conflict a certain way, but their command structure, their boss is telling them to resolve it another way, and potentially the board that they are licensed under is recommending a third way that they should resolve this. I think those cases are rare in any event. I don't recall those cases coming up, at least at the psych board. I've had to deal with this on the dental board. But the bottom line is right now the version that we have adopted has worked. And if there is that kind of a conflict, we, as the board, have to look at the 2010 version because that's properly incorporated by reference. A future version is not in front of us right now. So it's an easier way for us to deal with those cases if they come along. And I think if we do adopt the later versions, we are going to see cases where people are saying, oh, my ethics code tells me to ignore state law. Mm-hmm. My ethics code tells me to ignore what my boss is telling me. And those are thornier issues because if we do adopt it, and that's the argument that we come across, we are essentially, at that point, we have adopted a code that is creating an obstacle to achieving federal objectives. And that was the whole reason for the amendment at the APA, is, you know, the whole sort of fear-mongering that I have mentioned in the past. They wanted to touch the issue of torture and the stuff that was happening probably in Gitmo and all of these military bases. So that was the only reason why they amended the APA amended their ethics code. So now if a state adopts it, we are creating what's called obstacle, right? It's obstacle preemption. So a federal military agency is going to say, no, we don't care about your ethics code. This is our chain of command, and this is what I'm going to tell my inferior officer to do in this instance. But right now, we have the option of dealing with those ethics cases as a board because, you know, we have the 2010 code. And in the 2016 code, however,
it's 2003.
Oh, right? 2003. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah. I keep saying
we're at right now.
Yeah. We have 2003. We don't want to 2010, and we don't want 2016 is what I'm saying. So anyway, I've gone on long enough. I want to hear from other people. Thank you.
I am. And I just throw in mine. So if you go to page 55, which is the document that Heidi sent out, and this is the strike through, I strongly do not agree with taking out any language that talks about adhering to the requirements of the law, regulation, and other government authority and keeping with the basic principles of human right. We're a regulatory agency, and to approve taking out that our laws and regulations would have to be adhered to or acknowledged is basically saying that our statutes don't care, don't matter. We have statutes, we have rules. And the reality is, if an issue comes up, that's what we're going to look at. That's how we find someone, whether we determine whether someone is in compliance or not in compliance. And by taking language out, basically that takes away our authority or our legal means is not something we want to do. And I question, and I'm not the attorney, obviously, but you know, do we have authority to do that? Do we have authority as an organization, as a regulatory agency, to say, hey, we're not going to, you don't have to consider this, and we're going to accept that? I just don't feel comfortable with that at all. Dr. Meyer.
So this is come up before and you've both mentioned it, but just because they removed language from a previous version doesn't mean that that's now permissible. This is not saying you get to ignore laws. It's not giving permission. It's not saying that. What it does is removes the ability to say, for a psychologist to defend themselves, saying, I'm following the letter of the law, even though I'm practicing unethically. That we want to be able to say, no, we understand that this does not break the law, but we see this as unethical. So it's by getting rid of that, it allows us to hold psychologists to a higher standard. This isn't about being able to break the law. It's about saying, we don't care if you were following the law, you're still practicing unethically. Okay, but the old version says, no, it's ethical to follow the law regardless of what atrocious things I'm doing. Okay, so psychologists have always been held to a higher standard than the lay community. I mean, we have laws saying you can't have relationships with a former client. You've got two consenting adults that can have a relationship. We're saying, no, you can't do that because there's a power differential. There's a whole bunch of issues that come into play. And we're going to hold psychologists to a higher standard because of that influence they can have over vulnerable clients. And by removing this section, all it's saying is that you no longer get to hide behind the law. There's nothing that says you no longer have to follow the law. Okay. So I think that's where, like, I understand that we're looking at revisions, but if you look at the current, the most up-to-date APA ethical code, doesn't have the cross-throughs. It's saying, you have to try to resolve a conflict in keeping with basic principles of human rights. I think that's a reasonable standard to hold people against. Nothing in that says you get to break the law.
Madam Chair, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but I do not agree with it, because then why delete that language? Mm-hmm. Keep that language in. If the conflict is unresolvable via such means, psychologists may adhere to the requirements of the law, regulations, or other governing legal authority. The problem is when you delete that, you're deleting, you're just removing that from consideration. And the sort of more basic problem with incorporation by reference to begin with, remember, we are on very thin ice when we're incorporating anything by reference. And now the Arizona Supreme Court has said the same thing. You can't just say, oh, we have generic rulemaking authority. We have always held psychologists to a higher standard. That is not good enough anymore, at least since June of 2022. You have to specify the statute that gives you that authority. And the statute that gives us the authority is 16Z and 16DD. And in the Roberts case, a similar statute with respect to the Department of Administration was not good enough. The Arizona Supreme Court said that violates separation of powers, and the legislature has not delegated to the Department of Administration the authority to do this particular incorporation by reference, because you have not pointed to particular incorporation by reference authority. And so, I mean, we are on thin ice to begin with. And if we open this Pandora's box, it's a state constitutional problem. It's a federal preemption problem. We are creating a situation where the only purpose for APA to do this was some sort of, you know, some kind of political statement they wanted to make against the then current federal administration's torture practices. And I mean, political winds can blow here or there. I mean, I'm not a good predictor of those sort of things, but I think we have to acknowledge that's where the APA's incentive comes from. And that is not this board's incentive. That cannot be this board's incentive to say, oh, you know, we want sort of a referendum on torture of all of the board members. I mean, that you're just creating a situation where now you're forcing the board into a conflict that we have never seen occur. I have not seen one case on the psychology board where we have had to deal with this kind of a situation. So it's we are putting something, we are adopting something, incorporating something by reference. For what? Just for the feel-good factor that we did something against torture? And I'm not comfortable as a board member in taking any stance on this topic. And even if you forget the whole, you know, reason why the APA did this, you just go with the words of what they're doing. They're deleting a sentence that is protecting our laws, our statutes, and our authority. And it's just unimaginable to me that you could delete that sentence and put, under no circumstances may this standard be used to justify or defend violating human rights, and not have someone read that to mean you can ignore state law. I mean, you don't have to be, you know, a sort of wordsmith. You're going to have those kinds of interpretations offered by people, and you're creating a situation where licensed psychologists are going to actively disobey their bosses, are going to actively disobey our statutes, are actively going to disobey federal law on point, which, you know, part of that is, you know, convention against torture, like all of these international treaties, which the state has no role in. It's the president and the Senate that does it. No state touches those topics. So we are creating this huge giant mess of things if we adopt the 2010 and 2016 versions. I mean, I understand where you're coming from, not just Dr. Meyer, but people who want to propose adopting the 2010-2016 versions. I know it's coming from a good place. It's not coming from a bad place, but legally speaking, just practically speaking, it's just an unworkable, unconstitutional, irreconcilable standard with our nation's laws and with our state's laws. So that's where I stand on this.
Well, and I don't think I've heard anything new from you, Mr. Dinar, from previous discussions, and I don't think I'm offering anything new from previous discussions, and I don't know how to, like, I'm one of the ones pushing for this change, and there's not consensus, right, on the full board, let alone even in the committee. We've sent it back to committee to try to come up with something better, and it's apparent that that's not going to happen. At the full board, there wasn't a consensus. So I think at this point, it stays as is. There's not, I think my arguments are better than your guys's. But it's obviously not convincing you nor half the board. So I think it dies here. If somebody can in the future present a better case than what I've done and convince the board to make this change, then they have at it. But I think that I've tried. I don't see things changing. I appreciate your perspective and your points and your everything that you're bringing up. I don't think it's a feel-good thing to say torture's bad. I think that's a pretty clear-cut thing. But it's more than that. I agree. I disagree with the interpretation of what it means to cross out those lines, but we said the same thing about the ABA definition too, right? Like, if we cross that out, does it then give permission to start doing that? So I get it. I think at this point it's just no actions taken on this proposed change.
Thank you, Dr. Meyer. I just want to say too, I respect your position and your passion. I just think that we're, you know, there's a difference, and I definitely lean more toward, you know, Mr. Diner on his on his legal thoughts. So good discussion. I mean, it's a good discussion, good topic. Anything else?
Just, Madam Chair, just one thing. I want to thank Dr. Meyer for his efforts on this. I mean, again, I agree with you on many things. It's just this one thing that we have to, you know, disagree on, and that's fine. That's perfectly all right. Just one matter for like future things. I think we need to look at 406, which is the behavior analyst incorporation by reference of the BACB code, because it just is an open-ended thing, and because of the recent Arizona Supreme Court development, we have to take a look at it. So maybe in the future Rules Committee meeting, we discuss what to do with it. Again, with the hopes that there is like one version that we can submit to the Rules Committee and eventually to the board that would be acceptable. So something along those lines, I would appreciate if we can bring that matter to the committee. Thank you.
Thanks for those comments.
Can that not be discussed as part of this agenda item?
Well, it's the Excel spreadsheet doesn't have, I mean, I think like all of us need to study the version that will be presented for adoption by incorporation by reference. So we just need to make sure that all of us are looking at the same version. We have thought about that. So at some point, and it's not agendized, so. Mm-hmm.
All right, so we'll put it on the next committee meeting. Does that work, Heidi?
Yes, Madam Chair. And actually, one thing that I think maybe we want to pause and wait for too is that right now I'm preparing the 5-year rules review report to the Governor's Regulatory Review Council for, it's just for the BA rules. That's the only rules that that are due for the 5-year review. So it may be that GRC is going to come to us and say, that rule does not comply with ARS 41-1028. So the report's due the end of this month, and I would think that within the next 2 months, GRC will have us on their agenda to review it. So it may be that we need to, or compelled to do something with that rule because of that review.
Okay. All right. I think does that complete all of our items?
Madam Chair, that is all I had for you, unless anyone else has items that they want to bring up.
Dr. Meyer?
What happened to there was the proposal to add several words into the continuing education for diversity, and weren't we going to see if that was... if that was going to be considered a big enough change that had to go back out for public comment, or if we could just make those changes and proceed.
Madam Chair, if it's okay to talk about that. Yes. So I brought that question to our rule writer, who used to be the executive director of GRC, and she was quite confident that, you know, we could just provide the justification to GRC that it is a non-substantive change. And so that's what's been submitted to GRC.
Okay.
We're very confident that they will see that as non-substantive, and there won't be any issues. So it's the ball's in their court.
Great, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Great. Anything else or any items for future meetings, committee meetings? All right, if you think of something, let Heidi know. All right, thank you so much. Is there a motion to adjourn?
Moved.
Right, we got a motion. We got a second. It seems some excitement now going on. And thank you so much for your time. This has been a long, but I think a very good meeting. We've gotten through quite a bit of material. So again, Ms. Pacman, thank you so much for you and your staff. And Ms. Galvin, always thank you for your helping us out. So we got a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? If not, if you say something, I'm putting on mute. Nope, we're good. All right. You guys have a great day.